Welcome to the UMass Union of Madison and to our listeners on WIDELP. And, we're going to have a question and answer session today with Sean Francis Peters, who spoke earlier this morning, and I guess all of you were here for that as well. So, Sean Peters.
Sure, and I'm more than happy. It seemed like, judging from the how many questions there were earlier and how thoughtful they were and how profound some of the issues were, I'm more than happy to just keep going and address if there's some things that maybe we didn't talk about earlier that you'd like to get into. I'll do my best to make it interesting.
Within faith healing communities, they are not the only anti-medical establishment, or at least suspicion of the medical establishment, in our society. We have homeopathic medicine, which is, I think, in some instances, a faith. We have the traditional medicine movement, which is saying I shouldn't go and visit my friends who are accredited physicians, but instead I trust an herbalist who thinks that they understand the traditions of herbal medicine and can treat almost anything despite research. And then finally, we have a society that refuses to fund healthcare for children. And we have a large number of people who can't afford to go to a medical provider for treatment. And the real question is that any different?
Well, how do you mean, is it any different? Is it
the results? Because we have... We have people who die because they trust herbal medicine rather than traditional medicine, than whatever the medical community is called. We have people who can't get to health care because they can't afford it.
Right.
And the result is that we have loss. We have people who will go to an herbalist whose credentials I would think are totally suspect, but believe that that's going to treat their illness.
Right.
Is it any different?
It is. It's a little bit different in the sense that we're talking specifically today about children and children not necessarily having the capacity to make informed decisions of this kind on themselves. So in the case of faith healing, you have the parent making the decision, in effect, for the child. It's a little bit different when we have, you know, an adult saying, I've decided
I'm meaning to put that in the context of adults making decisions for children to treat them with one of these other methods as opposed to prayer.
No, that's a great question, and it's, first of all, this entire discussion is within the context of a completely dysfunctional healthcare system.
Sure.
We could look at, faith healing is only a tiny blip on a really massive problem of the radar screen, so to speak. I do think it's interesting that, legally it's defined as medical neglect. And I think that the way you frame, I guess what you're getting at is, if it's medical neglect, it's medical neglect. It's difficult, and courts do struggle with determining what is adequate medical treatment. And they oftentimes have a hard time determining what would have worked. And if you can get people together, you can put experts on the stand who will say, we don't know if medicine would have cured this. What I did couldn't have been medical neglect because medicine, people die in hospitals every day. That's a phrase that comes up in all of these faith healing cases. The defendants will say, well, prayer didn't work, but gee whiz, medicine doesn't work all the time either. So it's a wash. That is the claim that's made, and it's an effective rhetorical argument. Sometimes I don't find it to be an especially good argument when we're looking at, for instance, the Newman case, right? It's a pretty cut and dry case. You know, kid has diabetes, kid gets insulin regimen, child survives. It's a pretty cut and dry thing. There really isn't a lot of, that isn't sort of an open question as to that there was a particular kind of medical treatment and that particular kind of medical treatment would have worked, basically. What you're getting at, I think, is it's a great question, and I'm not aware of cases where, you know, a child has died as a result of being treated strictly by an herbalist, and whether the parents had been prosecuted for that. I tend to think yes, and actually they wouldn't be the parents wouldn't be protected legally because there's no religious those religious healing exemptions that I spoke of. They're for religious practice, and herbalism would not fall under that. So I actually think that those people could really be prosecuted freely. I just don't know that it actually happens quite that often.
I think, though, I don't want to tell you what you should or shouldn't do, but I think you're making a somewhat too sweeping statement of quote-unquote some herbalist. I pay a lot of money for a very good insurance at Unity, and in their big list of MDs, there are also a couple of naturopaths, and herbalist is not the same as a qualified.
I understand
and
the range,
and educated.
I'm trying. You know. What I'm trying to do is identify a group of people, and I know some people that are in this category.
Oh, yeah.
Who, if it's an MD, I would not go.
Yeah.
If it's anything that came out of a medical school, I don't want anything to do with it because those people don't know what they're doing. There's a whole other society of practitioners that I would trust instead of them. It's the category, and I don't know how to label that.
And that sentiment, yeah. Historically, it's not like that's a new idea.
Yeah,
historically, I mean, what we think of as being, conventional Western medicine really didn't work very well for a long time when people were being...
Yeah.
Pumped full of mercury, lead, all of these things. And it's interesting that the legal cases in this area develop in the late 19th century because medicine gets better. It's batting average kind of improves over time. Still, it's really not until even after World War II when you get antibiotics and penicillin and stuff that medicine really, I think...
more standardized.
Yeah, but it becomes... sort of as good as we would more effective, but if we're in the, let's say, the 1780s or something, praying for someone versus pumping them full of mercury and bleeding them, actually prayer was a pretty good alternative and Benjamin Rush signed the Declaration of Independence, most famous physician of his time, and that's that one. He was called the master bleeder, I think, and that was his cure for everything. Is cut him open and let him bleed. And faith healing, compared doing nothing, compared to giving people mercury, was actually pretty good. In my book, I talk about there's kind of a convergence in the late 19th and early 20th centuries where medicine gets better, the courts start to care more about kids, and you sort of have the faith healing practices are still about the same, but there's a collision between those three things, and that's why the cases wind up in the courts. Yeah.
Is it about that time that people began to get away from the notion that children were property?
Yep.
Because before that, not only were they property, they were the father's property.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. For a long time, children... the notion that children had legal rights, if you had asked someone, even as late as the early 18th century, was just completely... Right. And so we have, over the course of the 19th century, the notion that children should be protected. So things like child labor laws don't really work, but the idea that they're there and a child should be protected. You have things like public school, compulsory public school laws, for instance. All of these things sort of develop, and so you have child saving is sort of what it's called at the time. There are a couple of famous cases involving abusive parents and the courts intervening to save children from abusive parents and stuff. So it it's not like children are sort of ignored by the law until magically 1900 everybody wakes up, but it's clearly an evolutionary process. And further, that the state, another thing that to remember too is just our idea of governance is so different today than it was. I mean, the idea that the government should be big and powerful and do, regulate things in our daily lives is a pretty recent idea. I mean, the size of the federal government, the size of state governments has really expanded exponentially. So the states weren't, the police power that they did was pretty minimal. And it's only recently that, states have passed more laws and have enforced them more.
And many of those laws along with law in reaction to industrialization. Hmm? Because that's when kids were thrown into factories and it became more visible because there were more people in the city. And so then you got the reaction towards or against that from the philanthropist and the people with a conscience, in other words. So that's why this came out in the open. So industrialization in the turn of the century really brought about so many different laws and different aspects of
sure, there's a kind of, I'm not an economic determinist, but there's so many things in our history that you can look at and say, there was an economic impulse that sort of affected that. And clearly industrialization, and I mean, when you look at the resistance to child labor laws, textile factories, right, they wanted mill girls. They work longer hours. You wouldn't have to pay them as much. All of those things. So yeah, absolutely, that's part of it.
I think what Al might have been talking about is some of these new age people, some trust fund kids who were this way about, a little leery about immunization. Here's our daughter, both physicians. Oh, well, you mean it's really okay to give your kids the shots and all these shots cost this and the other? I think we finally got them persuaded that that was good. But now, if a child contracted a deadly disease, which might have been prevented by the immunization, has the courts ever done anything?
Wow, immunizations are part of the story. And
there's some bad stories about them.
There are many. I mean, the law is that you can, if in most states, have a religious exemption for immunization. If you think that your faith, if you can demonstrate that your faith prohibits you from giving your child an immunization.
So you're putting in a religious argument. There are these new
issues. All right.
They're not talking about religion. It's their belief, but it's not a religion.
Right.
What's the
difference? Right. Yeah, well, what is religion? Yeah, and that's, I mean, not to go ask the broadest question that there is, but that it's actually a very relevant question. And because when we talk about protecting religious conduct or allowing individuals to kind of operate freely in their religious sphere, these questions do come up. And why should religious conduct be more protected than, let's say, exactly, I'm a free thinker. I don't have a specific quote-unquote religious doctrine, but I have a sort of organized set of beliefs. Those really aren't, and this comes up in conscientious objection quite a bit.
That's what I was going to bring up. Right. And that's evolved. A generation or two ago for a conscientious objector to be seriously considered by the therefore it doesn't have to be a Quaker or a Mennonite.
Right.
And now conscientious objectors can be personal.
Right. Right, exactly. And it's what, the First Amendment is, and religion in particular it has a particular resonance with many people and has historically. And it's one of the reasons why these cases are really difficult is that behavior that if it were just completely secular many people would not even think twice about sort of regulating or policing. When it's ascribed to religiosity, then... Well, and people are reluctant to mess with it. People are just, whether rightly or wrongly, you know, there's the sense that maybe we shouldn't interfere. And it's different with, again, it goes back to children. And when children aren't old enough to kind of make these decisions for themselves and their parents are making the decisions.
Why isn't simply the child's right to life involved? If the child is too young to know what they're choosing,
infant,
why isn't the child's right to life involved in the legal innocence?
It's not the right to life per se, but it is, you're getting there. And that's why constitutionally states can intervene. The right to life is this obviously this politically loaded term, but the idea that the state has a duty to protect the welfare of the child.
So that, when the child too young to know what's going on.
Right, and that's generally that idea would hold sway if we didn't have these stealth exemptions to faith healing all over the place. Most states have those exemptions. 34 states, I think, including Wisconsin, that have them. And it's...
Can you give us a little bit about the history of how those came to be?
Sure. In the 70s, this is a really interesting story. In the 70s, the Nixon administration, the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, promulgated some requirements that mandated states develop laws that had these religious healing exemptions. And the idea was that if you want to get federal funding, you need to change your code to have these religious healing exemptions. And the question is, what was their motivation in 1974? There's been much speculation. And I will say, too, that the federal mandate ended in 1983, but states didn't go back and then undo their codes. So the question was, why in 1974 did the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare decide that they were going to do this? It has been suggested that there were several prominent Christian scientists in the Nixon administration. If you know your Watergate trivia, you know John Ehrlichman and H.R. Haldeman were Christian scientists. And... It has been suggested, and I have to say that there is no, you know, smoking gun memo from John Ehrlichman stating, hey, let's do this Christian Science thing. But someone has connected the dots and said, prominent Christian scientists, lo and behold, there's this exemption that clearly Christian scientists are the biggest religious denomination sort of associated with these kinds of issues. And that is perhaps where it came from. No one has offered an alternative explanation that I know of.
You argue that denying the right to life to kids under these conditions because of those exemptions is against due process, and therefore these regulations are unconstitutional.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that you could... if the constitutionality of the exemptions were ever litigated, I think that they would be struck down on establishment clause grounds, that the protection of a specific religious practice puts the state in the business of what we would broadly think of as being a religious establishment.
The stickiest situation of ordinary parents with ordinary children occurs at the beginning of life. At what point do you attempt to resuscitate a prematurely born fetus who is doomed to be abnormal even if it survives?
Right.
And what about horrible malformations that aren't correctable?
Right. The medical ethics issue is really extraordinary in all of these cases. And really, The medical ethics questions in many of the, for instance, this Newman case in Weston, are actually pretty easy. As a medical ethics matter, that case is actually pretty straightforward.
I can say something to that. It almost never happens that childhood onset diabetes, that many people live for more than 40 years after diagnosis, and many of them are gone much sooner than that in spite of what medicine can do. So it isn't as if you gave somebody a transfusion and they recover completely and become insurable.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. No one was saying that, that insulin would eliminate diabetes, but clearly she would have survived past Easter Sunday. That's pretty much, that's to the extent that there is a medical certainty.
She would have survived for decades, but she might well have needed a kidney transplant before she was 50.
Sure. And the idea, though, is that one argument that is often made is, well, let's keep her alive. And then, who knows, maybe 10 years from now, diabetes will be...
But it's
incurable now, but, you know, well, she'll never find... If she dies on Easter Sunday, she's never going to find it.
And from what I've read about this kid, and everybody's read about it, there were, I think, two relatives, one in particular, who were warning about this and
right.
who wanted... That's what made me think about the Good Samaritan law. Yeah. If they had gone to court... You know, if they had gone to court rather than just warn these religious fanatics, you know, they could have been
there. Was actually
for litigating
there was some contact actually between the parents and social services before Kara died.
Uh-huh.
They had been tipped off by a neighbor.
How long was she ailing?
Well, that's a question that was going to be worked out in court. The parents claim that she was lethargic and kind of dragging for, you know, a couple of weeks, but we didn't know sort of what it was. And then over the course of a weekend, she dramatically deteriorated and died relatively quickly. I'm no expert on diabetes, but their description of it was diabetic ketoacidosis. Other people who are experts on diabetic ketoacidosis have said that that's not really the way it's not. They have described it as more of a sudden onset type of phenomenon, and I don't necessarily believe that. Interestingly, Kara had gone to public school until December, and then was homeschooled starting in January.
She may have been sick then.
Who knows? Schools are a place where these things get picked up, where the teacher says, you know, I've got this kid and something's not right at home. Let's check it out.
Do you think that might be even why she was homeschooled?
I don't want to speculate, but the timing of it just seems curious to me. Another interesting aspect of this case that we haven't really gone into is that the Newmans were involved, they were connected loosely with an internet ministry. There's a ministry called, drawn a complete blank on it. It's an internet ministry based in Florida, and they were not affiliated with an established church per se. They sort of organized a Bible study around their kitchen table, and many people are suspicious of that. And when they're making this claim that they were involved in engaging in a kind of ongoing legitimate religious practice, many people have said, "Come on, they weren't really religious."
It doesn't quite sound like this.
It's definitely not as structured and bureaucratic as Christian Science.
Christian Science is the same all the time.
Right.
Never changes.
I will say about the the basement church. I have a hard time saying that that's illegitimate religion. I mean, if you look at the history of religion and how religions start, kind of how they start, it's just a group of people to get together. They start talking about their common beliefs. They find a sacred scripture, and that's how they start. So, it's
Christian Science also has practitioners, which is their version of a doctor.
Oh, absolutely right. Christian Science has another whole superstructure of. I mean, Christian Science is in some ways about healing. I mean, religious healing is not a tangential part of Christian Science. It's really the kind of bread and butter in some ways of what Christian Science is. Christian scientists, thus, are immensely concerned with these religious healing exemptions. And they will say that if you outlaw religious healing, right, if you say that people can be prosecuted for engaging in it, you're outlawing Christian Science. We're going to be prosecuted for being religious. It's not one of the 15 things we do to be Christian Science. It's really fundamental. It's a powerful claim to make. Whether it should be heeded or not, I don't know. But that's what Christian Scientists will claim.
I think it comes from someplace. When we don't know how to interpret something constitutionally, we go back to the intent of the makers. And they weren't thinking about medicine when they were thinking about religion.
No.
Or the interfaces between them. They were thinking about what they come from, and that people have the broadest latitude as possible in terms of what is religious belief and practice.
Sure.
And we tend to try to, a good court tends to try to go back to that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we get into a mess, because all this stuff about medicine has happened since we first had a constitution. And it's really hard to deal with things that weren't envisioned and that haven't got a natural, if you go from a mule to a horse to a car to an airplane, at least you have a transition in transportation. But when you go to things, stem cell research,
right,
totally impossible of being envisioned 350 years
right.
ago, you're in a hopeless situation. It's very hard, and the intertwining has got worse and worse.
Absolutely. And religious practice, just defining what is a religious practice. One of the things that the Jehovah's Witnesses really ran into when they first started going to court, they would say that the street is our church. This is what we do to worship, is that we go door to door. And for a while, the courts were just like, come on, you're kidding me. That's not really religion. That's something else. You're just doing this to make it a scam to kind of make money, and you're calling it religion. Again and again and again, we see religious practices kind of, especially so-called like fringe groups, the practices of fringe groups. We see this now with non-Western faiths becoming more prevalent because of the loosening of immigration restrictions in the mid-1960s. We're getting a lot more Buddhists and Hindus and people with all sort of Sikhs, for instance, and the use of the display of the ceremonial knife called the kirpan among Sikhs, and whether there are a bunch of court cases involving Sikh children wanting to bring a ceremonial knife or a ritualistic knife to school. And the schools say, wait a minute, we have a no weapons policy. We cannot allow kids to bring these knives.
Make them out of buffalo.
Well, and that, exactly. And it's what is this, for the kirpan to be a real implement, it has to be sharp. It doesn't have to be long, but it has to be sharp, and it has to be a certain length. And so if you were to make it out of something else, the Sikhs would say it's a phony thing and therefore not religious. So all these things, and to go back to your point about the framers had no concept that there would be Sikhs with kirpans trying to go to public school. Right? We just, I'm a big believer in the law being organic and changing and adapting. I think that's fine. But it is important to go back and think, well, why do we have a First Amendment? Right? Why did these people care about religion? Why is it the first thing in the First Amendment? Why is it really
so hard?
Exactly.
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 Yeah, and some of the Unitarians were against it because they were the Boston establishment.
Oh, right. Right, religious estate. And in Massachusetts, of course, had...
Maryland was the only one that was open, wasn't it?
Well, Pennsylvania, places like that. But, I mean, religious establishment existed in the states until the 1830s. And Massachusetts was, coincidentally, the last state to kind of get rid of it.
They kicked out Roger Williams.
Right. Before that, yeah, absolutely. Massachusetts was not a haven of religious liberty.
Although the established church in Massachusetts was the Unitarian.
Right. Right.
Right. I have a question. You know, we got briefly on the homeschooling issue. Now, how much of that homeschooling that's going on now comes out of the Yoder case? I mean, is any of that related in terms of permission to circumvent the public school system?
I think if you asked homeschoolers what is the most significant legal ruling supporting the entire notion of homeschooling, they would say Wisconsin versus Yoder. Because of the latitude it gives parents in controlling the education of their children, there had been a couple of parental rights cases before that. There's a case called Pierce versus the Society of Sisters, and there's this Meyer case from earlier. But Yoder is a case where parental rights in the context of education really are given incredibly wide latitude. Yoder, in some ways, is the, I don't want to say it's like the charter of the homeschooling movement, but it's really foundational to it. And again, they will come back and say, they'll invoke Yoder as a protection against state oversight and regulation of homeschooling, which I should say that the religious liberty part of Yoder is kind of diminished, but the parental rights part of Yoder is actually still, specifically within the context of homeschooling, is actually still pretty vibrant. And that's homeschooling is another. I mean, when you think about how incredibly regulated, overregulated, right, public school education is, everything is sort of by some law. And homeschooling is just, I don't want to say you can do whatever you want, because that's perhaps overstating it, but parents do have incredibly wide latitude. And that's something that, as there are more homeschoolers, I think will change. Homeschoolers will resist that. That's the reason why they are homeschoolers, is that they don't want to be overregulated, state-mandated, you know, no child left behind type of stuff.
So the reason, like when we were all, and I think I can speak for most everybody here, when we were young, homeschooling simply was not a thought, an issue. I mean, it just, unless you were out in the outbacks of Alaska or something, homeschooling simply was not.
Right.
Well, it was the missionaries' kids and consuls in some remote place.
Right, but if you lived in one of the lower 48, pretty much you went to, I mean, people, or your average person didn't think about homeschooling their kids.
Right.
So the Yoder case is really the wall between those days when you only homeschooled if you were a real rural or
right.
a missionary's kid versus now when the average person thinks about, you know, would that be a better option for
me? Right. In homeschooling, it's important to recognize the religious impetus for homeschooling. I mean, it really, it's certainly not all homeschoolers are profoundly religious people, but many of them, homeschooling sort of got momentum in part because devoutly religious people didn't want their kids to be over-secularized in the public school. For instance, they didn't want their kids to learn evolution. That was a big thing, is that they felt that that their religious foundation would be sort of...
But
right.
The evolution fight certainly predates the Yoder case by a long time. And
right.
People weren't taking... I mean, they were working with their schools, but they weren't taking their kids out.
And it's interesting, though, that they and the evolution, the creationists have sort of lost that. By the mid 70s, I think that they had sort of realized that the fight to insert creationism, maybe there was another way, rather than fighting to insert creationism in public school curricula, just take your kids out of the public schools altogether.
Absolutely.
Why don't we just say that there were elements in the public school system that parents didn't want their children exposed to?
Oh, absolutely.
Darwinism or many of the other things.
There are many elements and not strictly limited to religion. I mean, many people, I think, raise a legitimate question just about that overall effectiveness of the public school. And that's a real question.
Could you briefly say what the Europe case was?
Sure.
Maybe I'm the only person here who doesn't know. Is there anybody else who doesn't know
the
case?
Well,
okay. Several of us.
Okay. So in the late 1960s, a group of old order Amish parents in New Glarus, which is down in Greene County, were prosecuted under Wisconsin's compulsory school attendance law. And the law said children have to go to school until the age of 16. Just parenthetically, the parents get prosecuted. The children themselves don't get prosecuted under the compulsory school attendance law. It's the parents. The old order Amish claim that any schooling beyond the age of 14 would endanger their religious community. If you have 15-year-olds getting together, especially in a public school, the adolescents in their faith are going to become more worldly, they're going to be more corrupt, they're going to learn things and that would sort of pollute their religious community. So they resisted that law on the grounds that it violated their religious liberty. Over those 2 years, they only wanted to go until age 14. The law said 16. And the U.S. Supreme Court agreed with the Amish. And they looked at the totality of the circumstances. The Amish, they're really fascinating because defining what is sort of religious and what is secular to an Amish person, that distinction really doesn't exist in Amish culture. It's pretty much, and in many other cultures, everything is religious. Everything that you do is religious.
Everything you do is what?
Religious. And so saying, well, school education is secular and going to church is religious, it's just everything is religious. And the court said the state's interest in mandating those 2 extra years, it's kind of minimal. But the interest of the Amish in protecting their way of life is really immense. And so that the enforcement of that law against the Amish would be unconstitutional. And that's the Yoder case is really the point at which the U.S. Supreme Court gives the most protection to religious liberty. A lot of people criticized Yoder because it was sort of over-expansive in terms of its protections. And in fact, over the last, that was 1972, so over the last, 30-odd years, the Supreme Court has gone in a somewhat different direction. And now it's easier. The burden that the state has to meet when it wants to regulate religion is a lot lower. It's easier for the state to say, yeah, we have a legitimate interest in doing this. I'll add parenthetically about the Yoder case. I mentioned this to someone earlier. The case was framed as being absolutely necessary to preserve the Amish way of life in New Glarus. And again, during the arguments in the case, it was stated that if the Amish lose, their way of life will be destroyed, this community will be destroyed, there's great peril involved. And if you read the Supreme Court opinion in Yoder, Chief Justice Berger wrote the opinion, and he mentions that the very way of life is threatened. I don't know if you've been to New Glarus recently, but there aren't any, really, very many Amish people down there at all. And they all moved away. This is after they won this U.S. Supreme Court case. And in fact, the irony is that the Amish have a really ambivalent perspective on using the courts. Reluctant to, it's called going to law. They're reluctant to go to law. And there was a great deal, this is a really they're old order Amish, really conservative, and very when you get a lot of extremely doctrinaire people together, oftentimes things splinter apart. Old order Amish communities are famous for breaking up over things like electricity. Can you have a phone in your house versus a phone in your shop? And The the Amish participation in the Yoder case actually was the thing that helped. There's a lot of other stuff going on, but it helped break their community apart. It's incredible irony that the case that was supposed to preserve their way of life actually helped expedite the end. Jonas Yoder actually moved away. He moved to Missouri even before the case reached the Supreme. He was the first one to leave. And
there may have been some interaction with people.
Right. Think about it. He was the most famous Amish person in the United States. And there is no worse thing. If you're an Amish person, that
renowned.
It would be, it's completely upside down. And he moved to Missouri.
Did he change his name?
He didn't go so far as to do that, but he was
that's Yoder, though.
But that's a very common Amish name. Yeah.
It is. Yoder, Miller, and Hirschberger. If you ever tried, one of the defendants in that case was named Wallace Miller. And fortunately, he still lives down in Greene County. He was pretty easy to find, but I can't tell you how many Wallace Yoder. It's like John Smith. It's really
Sean,
pretty common. Yes.
One of the reasons I think for this, that historically it's been thought to have contributed to the prevalence of Yoder, is that they were a small group. We were not dispensing laissez-faire to Episcopalians or Methodists or Lutherans, something like that, or Baptists. Well, now we're talking different religious groups, for one thing. And for another, think about the Middle East and the fact that there we are talking about a culture thoroughly unfamiliar to us in which the law, religion, and the culture are seamless. They are one and the same thing. Now we're talking about a potentially very large group, but the law remains the same. Our law remains the same. And the latitude given by that law at the moment remains the same. And that's something to think about in terms of both incoming populations and how and why we are at war.
It's interesting to look at, I mentioned earlier, good religion versus bad religion.
Quote unquote,
good religion versus bad religion. The Amish, good religion, right?
Right.
They're so virtuous. They work the land. They don't bother people. They don't really pollute as much. And if you look at Yoder, is not the only Amish case. But when you look at any of the Amish cases, they have effusive in the judicial effusive praise for the quote Amish way of life. And clearly, the perceived wholesomeness of Amish life was one of the reasons why the Supreme Court fell all over itself to protect them. And as we get different groups coming in who maybe aren't perceived of as being quite as wholesome, the courts are much more skeptical. I've written a little bit about the Hare Krishnas and cases involving the proselytizing of Hare Krishnas. And the courts many courts just believe that the Hare Krishnas are a scam. It's just, it's not religion at all. And the Moonies are, the Unification Church is another one.
How did the Scientologists manage to get sanctified?
Scientology is another very interesting issue as well. And Scientology is a lot of it has to do with clout, and the Scientologists have
elected a lot of wealthy people.
Exactly, their route to clout has been somewhat different. They've gone and sort of courted celebrities and John Travolta and Tom Cruise and people like that as a way to legitimize and sort of, and it's very, whether it's good or bad, I won't say, but it's very effective, certainly. People don't.
Are they like the Amish?
Yeah, they're kind of the cousins.
Do they have a religious feeling about
medicine? The Amish, I can speak more authoritatively on. Typically, they will first turn to a folk remedy or even prayer. And then eventually, if that doesn't work, they'll kind of reluctantly engage medicine.
Some perfectly good standing Mennonites got medical school when it comes to
that. Right. So the Mennonites are more or less conservative.
They're
even
sort of halfway from Amish to Quaker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
The other direction of the state interfering, I'm on the local school board in Monroe, and I recently read in the school board journal that I think it's Milwaukee is sponsoring the Jewish school in the public school mm-hmm. system. Now, this
as a charter school or as a...
Presumably, this was just a little mm-hmm. news item, so I have no idea what it's going to come to or whether it's going to be considered legitimate
right.
with the taxpayers. And in England, of course, they are required, they have taken it upon themselves to establish Muslim schools in the public school system.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a totally different direction. Mm-hmm. It's very scary to me. Fragmenting what
our school choice in Wisconsin, it's a settled constitutional, as of today, it's a pretty settled constitutional issue that there can be a degree of state support for religious institutions. To me, it's a very convoluted, it's a little bit of a convoluted explanation as to why it is constitutional, but...
I want to bring up the Muslim religion now because not all Muslims, I guess, but many believe that Sharia law is spelled out in the Quran and other religious texts trumped the local law.
Mm-hmm.
Country that where the people have been living. And this happens in practice, as a matter of fact. There was an interesting story. The Three Cups of Tea story. What was his name? Markinson had a death threat from the local Muslims. And the question of whether he should be killed or not was decided not by any civil government, but by a court of clerics, Muslim clerics, international court in various countries. And they decided in the end not to kill him.
Right.
What he's got to say is he should have took months to get the message out and get it back.
You're raising a question, and I'll make it even more complicated. It's we're talking about in some ways, for want of a better term, higher law. In some ways, right? We have earthly law, and then we have a law that might supersede local law, right? There are many examples throughout history of higher law. For instance, Martin Luther King is a great example, right, where Martin Luther King Jr. said, I understand there are secular laws that mandate discriminatory practices, but my understanding of justice and equality that sort of transcends earthly law. And we look at that and we say, yeah, that's an admirable thing. If you were you were Nazi Germany and you resisted the so-called legal persecution of the Jews, right? Even though it was legal in a technical sense, obviously it violated sort of every moral law we can possibly think of. We would think that absolutely higher law, good thing. And then the times when higher law isn't so good, right? And we think, wow. And that's where it's, and I don't claim to have the, you know.
It's the good and bad.
Well, it is good religion versus bad religion. Exactly. And that's, I wouldn't, 9/11 is the sort of bomb in all of this, right? It's the example that is most difficult for people to get their minds around is the terrorists who purport to be religiously motivated when they engage in acts of killing. Those are really, really, really profound issues, and they're kind of hard to make sense of. And in some ways, I don't think that we have to make perfect sense of them all of the time. I think that we can be confounded and confused and contradictory if we so choose to be in interpreting those kinds of things. If we do want to say, certain types of behavior, just even in the name of, this maybe goes back to what I started with earlier today. And it's not just because you do it in the name of religion that it mean that.
We don't have this problem with the pick of priests. In principle, it's quite similar.
Well, do pedophile priests, do they purport to be, they're certainly using their religious authority to gain control of children, but do they claim that they are specifically acting on the basis of their religious beliefs, or are they just using their religious authority?
No, in terms of going after them, you can go after them with ordinary laws. You don't have to have any terrorism laws.
Oh, no, exactly.
So what's the matter with going after terrorists retail instead of wholesale?
Oh, right. Yeah, and that's another round. Talk about...
Can I ask, of course, to get back to the beginning, the religious healing exemptions, do you know the actual number for Wisconsin?
The number of the statute?
Yeah.
It's chapter 948, 0.06, I think.
This is criminal.
Yeah, so it's under crimes against children.
Okay.
And I want to, when I reference that part of the code, I want to be clear that it's not some vague law that's being twisted and interpreted in some. It really says in black and white, no parent shall be prosecuted by providing a bona fide spiritual treatment in lieu of medicine. It's not a crafty legal stretching of the law. It's very explicit.
I'm just asking, I want to write my senator, et cetera.
Sure. I will say that most of the people, and this might be a self-selecting group, but most of the people that I've spoken with think that that part of our law does not reflect public sentiment. 99% of the people who I've spoken to over the last several months have said that to me. And so... Your feeling about it is you're not alone in thinking. I do think that whether it needs to be repealed or whether it needs to stay, there does have to be a discussion. We've never, as a state, we've never had a discussion about that part of the law. And
well,
I don't know.
If they get rid of something like that, they could also get rid of the total faith healed kind men, which are the ones that come in and like Benny Hinn right now and stuff like that. They could work better at getting rid of those as well.
Right. Oh, those people are never going to go away. Yeah, I mean, they well, yeah, boy, fraud, religion and fraud is a really hard thing, not to crack for
this. Sure.
No, thank you. I think,
It
would be nice to sort of conclude or pinpoint some things that we can do something about, like your idea of maybe getting started, letter writing action on that, which might be talked about in the newspapers, and then you can have a greater discussion. But what about the general, the global picture? It seems to me that we need another Atatürk, you know, the guy in Turkey, who made Turkey a secular country. You know, we play around with this and still, you know, I'm a great admirer of the Constitution, but you know, we talk about the separation of church and state, and as long as I've lived in here since 1951, I'm an African citizen, there has not been a separation of church and state. The churches, and now of course it's very obvious, have an undue and pretty scary influence on everything, of almost any policy that's being done here.
Right.
And I think that is really something somehow needs to be addressed
so,
to get back to the separation.
I actually think that if you wanted that to happen, it actually has to come from the churches themselves. The most effective and I think resonant and practical argument is that the churches themselves and religious people themselves have the most to lose from the entanglement between church and state. Mm-hmm. And that churches, the more there are benefits to being connected with the government, maybe you'll get some funding, maybe you'll get some prestige. But the potential dangers are much greater. They're much greater. And we have seen, actually, many church leaders across faiths have actually taken the lead in trying to disentangle church and state. And I think that that's, to the extent that that, I hate to say that I don't think that that'll ever happen, but I don't know that it will. But that is the most effective way to go about it, I think, is for the churches to say, we think what we do is important and we will exist in our own sphere. It's better for us to sort of exist in our own.
Who, for instance, what churches except the Unitarians? But a big church.
Historically speaking, the Baptists.
The Baptists, yeah, were the first.
Very keen on the separation of churches. Yeah.
Exactly. So exactly.
Originally.
And in other
some
cases.
Still remember their history, but
most
don't.
Well, it was controversial for a long time after the Constitution.
And to the extent that the establishment has been a Christian establishment, Jewish leaders throughout American history have been at the forefront. If you look at the leadership of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, you'll see many Jewish figures associated with them.
Well, you're being pessimistic about our separation is diminishing and the wall is diminishing, but haven't even the conservative Supreme Courts pretty much gone back to the constitutional principle of separation?
They very grudgingly held on. First of all, that the separation of church and state is constitutional reality really only dates to about 1948. I mean, in terms of law, there wasn't a significant establishment decision until 1948. It has eroded, and yet it still exists. And the Supreme Court, I wouldn't overstate the importance of the Supreme Court in shaping all of these things. Clearly, the court mandates what is constitutional and what is depending on kind of what they ate for breakfast that day. They do decide these kinds of things.
So we didn't have a separation before 48?
Well, we did, but there wasn't the Supreme Court didn't really rule on the Establishment Clause until.
So nobody called it?
Yes.
More or less, right? So we have cases involving things like school prayer from the early 60s and stuff. I think that that's something that it gets worked out on the ground somewhat differently than what this it's like, unfortunately, integration. The Brown versus Board of Education, right, 1954, and schools are still segregated, really, throughout the United States. And religion and politics kind of works that way, too. The Supreme Court rules on things, and you know, it affects people. But it's not like it's a blanket lights on or lights off kind of thing. I will say too, in faith healing, there's never been a Supreme Court decision specifically about faith healing, and so it's really complicated. You have to look at 50 different states. It's a real kind of crazy quilt of law and interpretation and stuff, which. It's good for people like me because we can sort of step back and look at all these things, but it's really hard to say this is what the law is because it's not crystal clear.
At this point, I'd like to make when you were talking about Sharia and, you know, faith above the law, mm-hmm. that's what we have right now in the Bush administration,
right.
Because he ascribes a higher authority than the Constitution. So in name, I mean, we don't have it in perpetuity, I hope, but at the moment, that's the kind of theocratic government we have.
Yep.
I wanted to mention something that I found interesting that happened. When my first baby was born, I forget how old he was by the time he needed medication. But I went to the drugstore to pick up his prescriptions, and I gave him my name. And they didn't have any prescription for my name. He had it in his name. And at that moment, I realized he's a citizen. This tiny little infant is a citizen.
Right. Right.
I found
yeah.
that very intriguing.
And sometimes that's when we're having this discussion, it is beneficial sometimes to step back and think about that.
Yeah, man.
Absolutely. I mean, we talk about law and we talk about the Constitution and judges and all this other stuff. And it's really about children and determining what is in the best interests of children. And I know that that's a broad idea and there is no one route, one best way to do that. But sometimes we get a little, make things sort of overcomplicated. I think we think about too many other different things. And again, that's why the courts aren't the greatest place to work out these kinds of things, because sometimes the simplest, most effective decisions really can't be made in, not only in the courts, but just in the political realm. Things don't really work out.
We've reached the end of our hour, so let's thank our speaker, Sean.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.